Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. We're back at the Gallipoli Club for one of our early functions for the year, and we're joined by the New South Wales Minister for Finance, Dominic Perrottet. He's the Minister for Finance and Services. I'll introduce him briefly. Educated at the University of Sydney, the Member for Castle Hill since 2011, and most significantly, the Member for Finance and Services in New South Wales since April 2014. And the Minister's speech for tonight is termed The New Generation Gap, Ending the Age of Entitlement for Governments. Minister, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Jared, for that introduction. And can I firstly start by saying the Sydney Institute has always been one of my great sources for political knowledge. That's a testament to you. And I know that it was established back in 1989 when I was merely a seven-year-old boy. So I certainly don't remember or was not learned at the time of the great establishment of the Institute. My enduring memory from 1989 was the Tigers going down in that great grand final. But it's great to see that the Sydney Institute has had a much greater success since then than Balmain. But can I say that it's great to be here to, I guess, follow in the footsteps of some of my great political idols who have spoken here in the past and inspired me to, I guess, pursue a career in politics. From John Howard and Peter Costello, Matthias Cormann, and also Eric Abetz, who I understand may be coming later this evening. And also my good friend who spoke here recently, the Treasurer of New South Wales, Andrew Constance. So I'm very humbled and very happy to be here tonight. And I know that in this room there are many distinguished leaders from politics, from academia, from media and business. And someone, when I was younger, once said to me, make sure that if you are... Never put yourself in a position where you're the smartest person in the room, because you're in the wrong room. Well, tonight I can certainly say that I'm in the right room. So it's great to be here. In fact, it is really to the wiser and older people in this room who I would like to address most of my remarks this evening. And as we gather in this room tonight, most of the world's eyes are focused on Greece, where a radical left-wing party has recently come to power with promises to restore austerity, to reverse austerity, sorry, to rehire public servants and to raise pensions. And some say that they hold the entire fate of the Eurozone in their hands. And in a globalised economy, in my view, the aftershocks will certainly be felt here. But as we all know, Greece has had a pretty tough time recently, hit by a catastrophic cocktail of spiralling debt, severe spending cuts, and in many ways, widespread public unrest. But for me, one of the most telling statistics about Greece is that the rate of youth unemployment sits at 49.8%. Now, just think about that for a moment. One in every two young people under the age of 25 in Greece cannot find a job. Incredibly, though, Greece is not the worst case. Youth unemployment is even higher in Spain at 53%. Croatia is at 45%. Italy at 43%. Portugal at 34%. There's what people say about France. They're actually doing pretty well with only a third of their young people out of work. So as a finance minister, I guess I live in a world of numbers and statistics. But the problem with numbers is that they try to capture in one dimension issues that are not really numerical, but political, social, and often deeply personal. What metric can adequately capture the feelings of a young person who has studied very hard for years in expectations of a career, but now has very limited prospects of finding work? What equation can compute the toll on the human dignity of young people who continually apply for hundreds of jobs without a response? And how do we quantify the impact on individuals who have no hope, parents who cannot retire, and entire communities in despair? That is the true cost of youth unemployment, and it can never be communicated by just a number. And that's why I direct you, if you have the chance, to look at a video which has recently been posted on the Huffington Post website, which interviews a number of young Europeans who are struggling to find a job. "We can't find our way in life," says one. "Our parents are our personal welfare system," says another. "And we really are a whole generation of unemployed," says a third. The 20th century was meant to be a time of unheralded prosperity, brought about by benevolent big government. Instead, what we are creating is a lost generation. So what went wrong? Over the past 60 years, we were sold the notion that big governments would be our saviour. We were told that governments would end poverty. In fact, one of the things I clearly remember growing up was Bob Hawke's promise that by 1990, no young people would live in poverty. We were told that governments would provide free healthcare, free education, and jobs for all, with long holidays and fully funded retirements to follow. But despite the good intentions of many of these policies, a very different result has subsequently emerged. The toxic combination of big government, large public sector unions, unsustainable welfare programs, low birth rates, heavy labour markets, heavy labour market regulation and high taxes is a poison pill for economic growth, for innovation, and ultimately for employment. The old ways of big spending combined with what sociologist Daniel Bell has termed the revolution of rising entitlements have created a generation gap where the young will be paying for the excesses of the old. The legacy of these policies is a new generation that is disengaged, disenfranchised, and disillusioned with our political system. And that is why I come here tonight with a warning that the same things which we are seeing in Europe can happen here, in our nation, and in our state. I come before you tonight not just as the Finance Minister in New South Wales, but as a member of the younger generation of those just over 30, a father of three who is increasingly concerned about the future and that those younger than me will soon inherit. Edmund Burke famously said that society is a partnership between those who are living, those who are dead, and those who are yet to come. I say to you tonight that we are failing in that partnership. And that's why tonight I'd like to talk to you about why I think the biggest threat to the future prospects of young people today are governments that are too big, that are too greedy, and that are stuck in the past, and why a new model of government is needed in the 21st century. So let me begin with a story. A few years ago, a Greek journalist called Despina Antipa was growing increasingly worried about her job prospects. So after working a full day at the newspaper, she would attend baking classes until 10 p.m. at night and practice her pastry making skills on the weekends. After she and her husband both lost their jobs and went on benefits, Despina spent all her time trying to create the perfect French dessert. She poured the rest of her savings into starting a new bakery, building a website, creating a brand, and buying a shop. Things were finally looking good. But unfortunately, the bureaucrats had other ideas. Writing in the New York Times, Despina relates the nightmare of trying to do business in the Greek state. She discovered that she was required to forecast her profits 2 years in advance, and based on those forecasts, she was taxed at a rate of 50%. But worse than that, she was required to pay that tax regardless of whether she made that profit or not. But it gets worse. Despite needing just 20 square metres for a bakery, she was told she had to purchase a minimum of 150 square metres. And if this wasn't bad enough, regulations also required her to build additional toilets, fire escapes, and more walls. Ladies and gentlemen, there is no happy ending to this story. Her business was over before it began. And she and her husband, with their dreams and aspirations, left Greece. I've heard it said that if you train a man, you just train an individual. But if you train a woman, you train an entire family. Despina missed out on her dream of becoming an entrepreneur. Her family and her country are all the poorer for it. This story is instructive to me because it shows at a micro level what happens when governments get too big. Overregulation is the calling card of big governments. Red tape strangles new businesses, smothers innovation, and suffocates ideas. And since small businesses provide the majority of jobs, it's the classic case of killing the golden goose, the goose that lays the golden eggs. But this story is by no means unique to Greece. Every single year in Australia, state and federal governments pass over 25,000 pages of legislation to regulate our lives. That is more than double what it was 20 years ago. The other defining hallmark of big government is that it crowds out the private sector, something that I found out firsthand when I was appointed as a minister just last year. The New South Wales government runs a fleet of nearly 30,000 cars. So as well as a government, we're also fleet managers. We build and maintain our own computer systems, so we're a technology company to boot. And we have our own portfolio of buildings and properties, and we're also in the real estate game. This is not to mention storing our own paper records, running our own call centres, constructing our own buildings, and even employing our own stonemasons. It's hard enough to run one business, let alone running dozens. Jim Collins, in his book, which many of you may have read, Good to Great, says that companies who want to succeed should work out what they are the best at and stick to it and do nothing else. And governments, I believe, are no different. The core business of state governments is service delivery, and being too involved in other activities is a distraction that will cause our core business to suffer. And that's why here in New South Wales, under the leadership of Mike Baird, we're making service delivery a priority. And it's why we've employed more frontline teachers, nurses and police, and less back office bureaucrats. And it's why, as Finance Minister, one of my key aims is to get us out of businesses that we shouldn't be in, and let the private sector do what it does best and return those savings to the bottom line. Greater involvement by the private sector is what people want as well. A survey just last year of millennials across 17 countries found that 73% of them believed that governments couldn't solve societal issues, and 83% wanted corporations to be more actively involved. Trendwatching.com cite this research in their predictions for 2015. They say that one of the emerging trends over the next 12 months will be what they call branded government, where business identifies government shortcomings and then, acting in partnership, gets more involved in service delivery. It's one of the enduring myths that smaller government with private sector partnerships help fewer people. But just yesterday, the Premier launched Australia's first social impact policy, and this follows the social benefit bonds, which he brought in 2013. Yet while pursuing a lean government focused on service delivery would seem to be a common sense approach, it's worth pointing out that this has all been achieved in the face of strong opposition from the New South Wales Labor Party. I encourage you all to visit the New South Wales Labor website and read their statement of principles. It talks about the struggle of the working class against capitalism, the redistribution of power, and the socialisation of industry. Labor might have their party principles published on a flashy website using modern free market technology, but it's clear they're still partying like it's 1969. In politics, ideas matter. They animate governments, politicians, and policies. The ideas of individual freedoms and free markets have been part of the Liberal Party platform and have stood the test of time. In fact, back in 1942, Robert Menzies was warning of future governments that would nurse us, rear us, maintain us, pension us, and eventually bury us. In contrast, as Nick Cater has written, when Whitlam spoke of that style of government, he meant it as a promise, not as a threat. Try as it might, Labor cannot easily escape from its roots as wealth takers, not wealth makers. But as well-intentioned as this agenda may be, it's the path that leads to ruin for the next generation. Governments in the 21st century should not be too big. But they don't necessarily have to be too small either. What they need to be is lean and doing only what they have to do and doing that very well. It's not just big governments that are the problem, though, but governments that take too much. Many of you would have heard of the French 75% super tax on earnings above 1 million euros. It was introduced a few years ago, and it was described back then as Cuba without the sun. But what you might not know is that on the 1st of January this year, that tax was quietly scrapped, as many of the rich simply took their capital elsewhere at an even greater cost to the French economy. Rather than trying to do the hard work of boosting wealth creation, many governments simply want to take wealth from their citizens and spread it around. When businesses go through tough times and capital is tight, they cut down, they trim back, and they become more efficient. They do more with less, as the mantra was during the GFC. In contrast, many governments in tough times simply turn to their citizens and increase tax rates, often to fund ineffective and unnecessary programs, in other words, doing less with more. There is no doubt that we as citizens should be paying government taxes for the provision of necessary services. The problem is, governments do a lot of things that they shouldn't be doing, and what they do, they do very inefficiently. And I think it's fair for our citizens to ask if they're getting value for their tax dollar. Unfortunately, in many cases, the answer is no. For example, over the past 40 years, the US government has invested over $22 trillion on the war on poverty. And yet the poverty rate has remained pretty much exactly the same as it was when the program began. In one of my favourite political speeches, A Time for Choosing, Ronald Reagan made the same point about the tendency for governments to throw even larger sums of money at problems, despite not making any progress or improving outcomes. He said, each year that the need grows greater, the program grows greater. No government ever voluntarily reduces itself in size. So government programs once launched never disappear. Actually, a government agency, he says, is the nearest thing to eternal life we'll ever see on this earth. Reagan gave that speech back in 1964, and since then, things have only become worse. Government spending as a percentage of GDP is at record levels. In Australia, it's 39% of GDP across all levels of government. In the UK, 41.2%, while Greece is at 53.8%. Debt levels are also increasing, with ours at 41%, the UK at 97%, and poor old Greece at 163%. What these numbers tell us is that governments are spending too much, they are borrowing too much, and they are living beyond their means. And to finance all this, they're going to once again tap their citizens on the shoulder. And it's here that I have to partially disagree with someone that I have a lot of respect for, Federal Treasurer Joe Hockey. A few years ago, in a speech he gave, he proclaimed the end of the age of entitlement for citizens and businesses. He was half right. It is not just citizens who need to realise that the age of entitlement is over. It is governments as well. It's become pretty clear that simply confiscating ever-increasing amounts of money from citizens to prop up ineffective programs is not only unsustainable, but a betrayal of social and generational justice. That's why, to me, the current calls by some Liberals to broaden the tax base of the GST is misguided. Not because it's necessarily the wrong move, but because it's the wrong conversation. The GST is simply a mechanism for collecting tax. It's not a tax policy. As some commentators have noticed, simply broadening or raising the GST in isolation is more of a tax grab than it is tax reform. The only question Liberal governments should be asking is, how do we reduce the tax burden? But we all know that tax reform is difficult, and that tax reform simply can't happen, in my view, without changes to our federation. The starting point, as some have suggested, is to clearly mark out the responsibilities of each levels of government. This will reduce duplication and unnecessary cost. In that context, the mismatch between Commonwealth and state taxes can be addressed, along with the current distribution model, which rewards mediocrity and offers states very little incentive to undertake substantial economic reform. And while the federation debate takes place, it's worth asking how governments can deliver services whilst not raising taxes. And one way is by making better uses of the assets that we have, like what we are doing here in New South Wales. Our program of asset recycling means we can lease existing assets to private buyers and then reinvest the proceeds realised from those sales into much needed infrastructure. For example, in my portfolio, we currently own two historic sandstone buildings on Bridge Street. These offices currently house back office bureaucrats in prime CBD real estate and cost taxpayers millions of dollars to maintain. This makes little economic sense, and that's why we're leasing them out as high-end hotels to create jobs, reduce costs, and boost tourism. On a bigger scale, leasing the 49% of the electricity networks of poles and wires will see us raise $13 billion that will be used for major mass transit projects, light rail, and a second harbour crossing. And it won't cost our citizens a cent in additional taxes. A Deloitte report estimates that our infrastructure agenda will bring over $300 billion to our economy and create over 120,000 jobs. With the Brotherhood of St Lawrence putting the youth unemployment rate here in New South Wales at 11.8%, this is a much needed program of job creation which will provide benefits across the board. Asset recycling and building infrastructure is one way governments can do more with less. In contrast, governments that are too greedy take capital away from individuals and businesses who need it and funnel it ineffectively to places that don't. The final way that governments are letting down their citizens is by being firmly stuck in the past. I've often told the story that when I first became a finance minister and I went into the office and opened up the stationery cupboard, I found boxes and boxes of 3.5-inch floppy disks. I didn't even know that we still made those things. But there they were, positioned in the cupboard just in case the government ever had a need for them. But today, I actually have an update to this story because I'm pleased to tell you that, in fact, we're not alone. The Business Insider reported last month that in some parts of the US, governments still rely on the humble floppy disk. Apparently, not everyone over there has upgraded to email. And so agencies are currently scanning documents, saving them onto the floppy disk, hiring a courier to send them between agency to agency. So, in my view, nothing really illustrates the disconnect between the youth of today and governments more than technology. While our young people are transacting on their phones, instant messaging their photos, and video calling their friends, government technology remains firmly fixed in the past. Entering many government departments is like stepping back in time. This is a world of paper forms, of fax machines, lining up in queues, and constant inconvenience. Many governments are designed and built around themselves rather than being designed and built around the citizens. For example, when we took over government here in New South Wales back in 2011, we inherited a network of over 380 shop fronts, over 100 different call centres. We had more than 1,000 different New South Wales government websites and over 8,000 different New South Wales government phone lines. So by redesigning government around the customer, we instead have created Service New South Wales, a single agency with one phone number, one website, one mobile app, and over 800 different transactions from across government departments. So far, we've served 10 million customers with a satisfaction rating of 98%. Unheard of in government to have a satisfaction rating of that high. I also believe governments are also neglecting their citizens by not deriving full value from the data that they hold. There is an increasing realisation in the business world that data is so much of an asset that it should be counted on the company balance sheet. Wired magazine called it the black gold of the 21st century. In my opinion, the full value of this data won't be realised by governments, but by the private sector, which is why an open data agenda for governments is very important. Some of you here tonight may have on your phones the train, bus or ferry apps, which were created by the private sector using our data and are a sign of what is to come. Technology is not just changing government, but is changing society. I've spoken since I was appointed minister many times about the collaboration economy and the opportunities that it presents. We now have a new generation of companies specialising in connecting people who own things with those who simply want to borrow them. In other words, doing more with what we have. A few months ago, we announced that instead of relying on our own fleet of cars, the government would conduct a trial of car sharing. So we'd get the benefit of using cars without the cost of owning them. More importantly for me, though, the collaboration economy is creating a new generation of what are called micro-entrepreneurs. And these are people who will use these services as alternative income streams, such as people renting out spare rooms using Airbnb. There is no doubt the emergence of the collaboration economy is creating challenges for regulators around the world as they challenge the status quo and disrupt traditional business models. Yet the new opportunities for businesses, collaboration and job creation should be highly encouraged by forward-thinking governments. In that vein, it was disappointing to see the Shadow Assistant Treasurer at Labor MP Andrew Leigh recently calling the government to start taxing not only these companies, but also the income that ordinary people were generating. It reminds me of Reagan's quote that the government's view of the economy, if it moves it, tax it, if it keeps moving, regulate it, and if it stops moving, subsidise it. Yet, yes, every company should pay their fair share of tax. But my view is that apart from safety and security, the collaboration economy should be allowed to grow organically and not be squashed by the clumsy hand of big and greedy governments. I can't be too critical of Labor, though, without taking a good look at my own party too. In a world where I can do just about everything online, the one thing I can't do is join the New South Wales Liberal Party. If you head over to their website and click the join button, you're presented with a PDF, a paper form you have to print off, handwrite on, buy an envelope, affix a postage stamp, and then post it off to their headquarters. In an age where political party membership is ageing and youth are disconnected from politics, nothing says that you are more stuck in the past than paper forms and postage stamps. The Western Australian Liberal Party allows their members to join online, and we should do it here too. Governments do not need to be world leaders when it comes to technology, chasing after every fad, but we should be fast followers and emulate what is working. Rather than lag behind the times with outdated ideas, governments need to be mobile, social and connected, meeting our citizens where they are and not dragging them back to where we want them to be. In conclusion, my contention is that many of the economic and social policies put in place over the last 50 years by our political leaders have been well-intentioned but tragically short-sighted. They have pursued instant gratification over long-term success. They have been more about winning elections than winning the future. And they have benefited those in the present at the expense of those who are yet to come. It is one of the enduring laws of nature that no one has ever run up a tab that they haven't had to pay. The current political class is running up a significant debt, and it is the next generation, those who are yet to come, will be paying the price. C.S. Lewis once said, "We all want progress, but if you're on the wrong road, progress means doing an about turn and walking back to the right road. In that case, the man who turns back first is the most progressive." It is time now for a new progressive thinking. The era of big, greedy, and backward governments has to come to an end. What is needed now is a model of lean, efficient, and connected government that can better fulfil its original purpose, to serve its citizens that elect us, both those who are here and those who are yet to come. Thank you.
Many thanks to Dominic Perrottet for a very forthright speech tonight, quoting Edmund Burke and C.S. Lewis and more besides. So many thanks for that. So we're coming to questions and discussion. We'll finish at the top of the hour, the normal procedures, and thanks again to the Gallipoli Club for providing the facility. You spoke about asset recycling and the ambitious plans your government has to lease poles and wires and use the proceeds to build bridges and tunnels and roads, infrastructure leading to productivity increases. But we've seen in Queensland where Labor has campaigned against that, in spite of the fact that Labor had done a lot of privatisation under the Bligh government in Queensland, and that seems to have worked. Do you think you can bring people with you in New South Wales, which is, you know, is the most prosperous state in Australia now, but do you think people are that fixated on productivity, or do you think you can be smothered on this kind of issue?
Well, look, I think it's tough for governments to reform, and I think I spoke about that in the speech, but if we believe in something that we think will provide benefits for our state, then we should pursue it. But that's a challenge. And I think what we've seen in Queensland is that you need to bring people with you on the journey. And governments, you know, there was a saying that many people have said that, you know, if you have good policy, the politics will follow. Well, I think now with the 24-hour news cycle, that is a view of the past. Governments may have good policies, but you need to have good politics alongside it. And if you are going to embark on substantial reform, which governments should do, then you need to not only lay the foundation for why that change is required, but you also need to sell the message and bring people with you. And if you can't do that, then really you shouldn't embark on reform. And obviously I would expect in this upcoming election that Labor will once again oppose us as they have done in Queensland, but I think, you know, we have a popular premier here. I think we have a very strong narrative in New South Wales. I think the public understands what we're doing when it comes to the leasing of these assets. We've clearly tied that to productive infrastructure delivery, you know, and I think that's easier, an easier message to sell than, you know, paying down debt. I think if you can show that you're investing proceeds from the sale of assets, or in this case, the long-term leasing of assets, and putting that and those funds which you realise from those transactions, you're investing it into infrastructure that is tangible. I think the public, you can take the public with you. And when you, I think if you ask anybody in New South Wales what the biggest issue here is, I would say that they would argue it's infrastructure. So when people are sitting in congestion every day on our roads, they realise that something has to change. And I think the fact that you know, we need to look at new ways and look out of the box about how we fund these projects going forward. But I think it's a sad day if people take out of the Queensland election that we shouldn't proceed, state governments should not proceed to reform. That is our role. But it is also our, and I've had a lot of Liberals since that election in Queensland say doom and gloom, but I think they had a number of other issues up there. But you know, you don't blame people, you don't blame the public. It's not a, you know, it's not about, if you're running a business, sure, you know, you make tough decisions, but you don't have to bring people with you. Politics is a completely different game. If you have to sell a message, and you have to take people on a journey, and I believe that's what we'll do here in New South Wales.
So I go to Dimitri. If I repeat a question, just so it's get picked up on the microphones. Dimitri.
Minister, thank you for your presentation. I also remember in 1986, Ronald Reagan said the 10 most dangerous words in the English language are, I'm from the government, and I'm here to help you. And to your story of Despina, I challenge you to set up a financial services business, navigate through ASIC. But my question to you is, the federal government has successfully had a minister for deregulation.
Yep.
And they've undertaken a program to look at deregulation and, you know, repeal legislation. Yep. Is there a view for that in New South Wales?
Absolutely. So we have a one-on-two-off policy, but what I've found in my time in government has been that that's kind of, you know, when you're talking about taking off regulation, it's taking off the right regulation. What I've found in these circumstances, Victoria had the same thing. They had someone who advised them on cutting back on regulation. But what I've found is that the regulation that generally gets cut back is archaic regulation, like, you know, regulating, you know, horse and carriages, which no longer exist. Yeah, I think it's something that we certainly should be focused on. I think when you look in the media, a lot of the time people say if you cut back on sitting times in Parliament, you know, politicians are being lazy. Simply because we're in Parliament passing legislation doesn't mean that's a good thing. But in the eyes of the public, a lot of the times I think people think that it is. So they've certainly embarked on that path in the federal government. But what I think is important there is that they're actually addressing the right regulation that they should be targeting. And I think that's the challenge for government, is not simply having a numerical figure that we've taken off, you know, various aspects of legislation. What regulations are we actually looking to do? And ones which we should be, you know, reducing are ones which help productivity and help small businesses, you know, prosper.
So there's a question over here. Thank you.
That's pretty strong delivery. You mentioned with this asset recycling. Have the large Australian superannuation funds shown any interest in that? And in your view, is that a good idea?
Have the large superannuation funds in Australia shown any interest in asset recycling?
Yeah, well, I think that there has been that interest. But, you know, I don't want to preempt the market and what happens in the course of, you know, obviously we've got to be elected and we go down that process. But I believe there is strong interest. And further than that, I think that the interest that we'll see as a result in what's happened in Queensland, I think that the market will... there would have been, a bit more of a flooding of the market in that circumstance. It won't occur now. But I think the interest in our assets across the board is very strong. And I think people want to have, you know, these are good assets. They have a good return. And I think, you know, superannuation funds are certainly a target for us in that space. And I'm very confident that they've shown an interest and they will, you know, if we get through the election and pursue this path.
Fish down the back.
I just wanted to follow on from the Jared's question about Queensland, which has obviously put, along with Victoria, put the spook into the federal government and about one-term governance and the inability to retire government debt, which was planned in Queensland, which has lost a AAA rating, I believe. And there's something along the lines of Greece with its debt ratio. So my question is related to this plan to New South Wales doing the same thing. In Queensland, there seemed to be a successful propaganda campaign, not based on, hey, we're actually feather bedding and trying to predict their feather bedding, and of course we're actually protecting you, the consumer, from higher costs. And yet the report in the Financial Review yesterday, I think it was, had information from Ernst & Young and from the ABS suggesting that in fact the Victorian and South Australian experience was better for the consumer. So what's the truth, what's the reality as far as you're concerned?
Just to summarise, the suggestion is that the Victorian South Australia, where electricity assets are being privatised, that costs are lower than in areas where they haven't been. Right?
Yes, so I read that report, and that Ernst & Young report is obviously something that we have read thoroughly, and the advice that we have from Treasury is that the experience is that taking this approach will put downward pressure on electricity prices. Now, the unions will quote a survey and a scare campaign over the course of the next 2 months that electricity prices have actually increased in Victoria and South Australia. But the actual facts, as you say, they're on the table, is that the experience is exactly the opposite. But, you know, the unions will run those scare campaigns. They did that, obviously, quite effectively in Queensland. But I also think there are a number of other issues in Queensland outside of this, which led to their demise. And I think that, you know, if you're going to take on a substantial reform, and this is a substantial reform that we are embarking on, that you need to not do too many other things or pick fights with too many other people, because that just takes away from your core narrative. But on your point as well about, which you made at the start, about the volatility of the electorate, I think that clearly in Queensland shows that the public are very willing to vote out a first-term government, and you probably have a cabinet up there that's going to be half of which we made up of members who aren't even currently sitting in the parliament. So the public, you know, are certainly happy to vote out a government if they're not happy with them, and that's why it's important, as I said, that governments bring the public on the journey. And that means you don't do too much. Well, you know, you don't do too much. You don't spread yourself too thin. You focus on what your core objective is, and you pursue it, and you sell the message why we'll be good. Because you're not doing it willy-nilly. You're doing it because you believe the state needs it. So if that's what you believe, then, you know, that ability to sell that message to the public can come from it.
Question there, and then we go there. Yeah.
Can you give some examples of policy that's been, you think, has been sold really, really well
from a New South Wales government perspective? Well, I think if you look at our economy and what we have done, and I think the message that we've sold from turning around the state's fortunes, I think has really come out very well. And I think that's elevated by the fact that the current premier was the former treasurer. But I think if you look at what the state of New South Wales was prior to the election, being behind on all those key measures of business confidence, retail growth, housing starts, business confidence, we're at the lowest levels, we've turned them all around, and I think that message has come clearly through. But also an infrastructure agenda. I mean, we've gone from a government here in New South Wales who, under Labor, promised so many projects but failed to deliver them. I mean, where I'm from in Castle Hill, the North West Rail Line is probably the best example where, you know, Labor promised the North West Rail Line when I was at school, and they promised it and then pulled that promise three or four times. The fact that that project is well underway and people are seeing the North West Rail Line across that whole sector being developed is a strong signal to the public that we are a government doing things. Take the Opal card, for example. I think one of our strong areas over the last 4 years has been in transport. The Opal card, I mean, that was promised to be delivered for the 2000 Olympics. And, you know, once again, promised they couldn't work it out numerous times. It was years of poor process and governing on that area, and we've delivered that. So I think on those key messages of infrastructure, transport delivery, people understand and can see what we are doing, and they're confident that we're delivering. And that's why I think the message that we're bringing with this asset recycling, investing in infrastructure, feeds clearly within that narrative. And I think people can see that we have a plan that we've delivered so far and what has been one term of government, and that there's plans for the future. And I think when you've delivered a strong government where there is infrastructure occurring across the state and you have a plan to do more, that people understand that the future is strong with the current government.
Minister, thank you very much for a very good address. And as the father of a daughter who has made over 200 job applications without being able to get anything other than part-time casual work, thank you for recognising the issue. My second question is, in the address you talked about how you were getting bang for your buck in government and how important that was, and there was a phrase there that really stuck out to me, and that you were so happy in that you were employing additional teachers rather than take other staff. Given the amount of the state budget already taken employing the teachers, and given the very, very iffy information on how effective the employment of those teachers are, my question is finance and or treasury involved in the evaluation of the effectiveness of the additional costs?
Okay, so the question is, who's involved in the evaluation of additional costs for employing, say, teachers at the front line?
Look, that's
your department or Treasury?
Oh, that would go through Treasury and obviously through the Education Minister. But can I say that the point you're getting at is a very good one. I think a lot of times in government, we focus on process and we focus on announceables you know, we want to, you know, we want to announce that we're having, you know, X amount of teachers. Where we should be focused is on what is the need, and then work towards that. So let's take, for example, public housing, and you know, one of the tougher decisions that we made was our decision with Millers Point in this government. And what we have said out of that is that the proceeds from the sales of those properties will be reinvested into public housing. And that is important. That is important. What you don't want to start with is the end goal of saying whatever the proceeds are is going to deliver this much of public housing. What you need to start with is how much public housing do we need, and how much funding do we need to deliver that, rather than having the funds determine what the need is. And this is one of the challenges you'll always find in government, and I've certainly found that obviously being in a central government agency, is you have all of these, you know, government departments operating in silos and all looking after their niche areas and promoting their own ideas and what they feel is important. That is an important part of the process. But through the Expenditure Review Committee, you have those members of central government. Those ministers have to present, and they have to present, whether it's teachers, whether it's police, whether it's nurses, they have to prosecute the case for why there is a need, and governments need to ensure that they meet that need, and where there is a void, that it's filled. But you're right, and I think it's very important for responsible governments to not be simply focused on a nice announceable when the need's not there. But those issues across the board with teachers, nurses and frontline services, that it's important, and I certainly believe that the New South Wales government is delivering in those areas where the need is.
There's a question here, yeah?
Minister, asset recycling to fund productive infrastructure is certainly a welcome initiative for the state. Broader than that, and for the benefit of the state, it's the opportunities during the construction of those infrastructure projects that's got the immediate effect on jobs. What's the government plan in terms of engagement of local industry, in terms of full, fair, reasonable access to these projects, and in terms of ensuring compliance for these long-lasting assets?
Okay, asset recycling, what's the government's plan to ensure that these positions are available to Australian industry? Right?
Well, that will be a key focus. I mean, we're not there yet. We've got to get through the election. But can I say, on a number of these infrastructure projects, whether it's the WestConnex, whether it's the North West Rail, these projects, these major infrastructure projects that were non-existent before, are employing a number of young people across this state. And as I've said, in terms of the estimate of the jobs that will be created from our infrastructure program, if we are elected, is over 120,000 jobs for people across New South Wales. So it's not creating jobs for the sake of it. It's creating jobs to build infrastructure to help the state. And that's where our focus should be. Governments shouldn't be in the business of creating jobs for the sake of it. We should be in the business of creating or building infrastructure that people need, and then the jobs will necessarily flow from that. And I take your point, it's important, and it will be the case, that these projects will be employing vast amounts of people, and particularly young people, in New South Wales.
Right down the back. Yeah.
I just have two questions.
Got to be quick.
Okay, number one is, why do you sell only 49% of this property? Why? How effective?
Lease.
Someone mentioned about super funds. Bearing in mind, if you ask the super funds to invest in infrastructure, you need to let the fund know what's the rate of return.
Yep.
So have you got some kind of...
Well, we're not at that stage.
Okay, so why do you only lease 49%? And if you want super funds to invest, what are you going to tell them about the rate of return?
Yeah, well, obviously that will be part of the process, and we're not there yet. And it's not for me, in my position, to be preempting that process well in advance of the potential lease if we are successful. On the 49%, well, look, we believe that this was a position which would give us a strong financial return. At the same time, we work in it. You know, there were serious concerns, as you would know, with our coalition partners in the National Party. And we've worked very, very well to ensure that the concerns in rural and regional areas were looked after. I believe that, you know, the process that we've taken for a 49% long-term lease is one which I believe that we can take the public with us. And I think it's one where when we're talking about a $20 billion infrastructure program that we have, it is through the 49% lease that provides us with the requisite funds which will fund that infrastructure program. So once again, you're looking at what do you want to be delivered? Where is the government going? The government is going towards that spend. That's what we see the need as, and then how do we fund it? So it's not about saying, let's go all out and do everything at once. It's about saying, looking at the outcome and then making decisions that will help us deliver the infrastructure that we need.
Right down the back. Minister, I very much enjoyed your message of small and lean government. And I'm worried that I can't remember a state election in my lifetime where any party, either party, has campaigned on we're going to cut the taxes. And the reason for that is the state governments as the Federation is currently structured are effectively welfare dependent on Canberra. And so all the initiatives you mentioned the government's doing are very commendable in trying to make government lean, but they're really not doing that much because the state governments don't have that much capital. They hardly have any taxation power. So I would think...
Got to be quick. Yeah.
In the long term, we want to halve the amount of taxation revenue that Canberra takes in, and we want to bring back what we used to have before World War II, income tax and company tax for the state, so that we can have a state election and we can have a debate about cutting taxes or increasing taxes to pay for services.
Okay, so suggestion is that states like New South Wales should be able to raise their own taxes or decrease the taxation for the people of New South Wales.
Well, thanks, John. Can I say we certainly have an intention at this stage of bringing back state tax, but the point that you made overall, I mean, the state governments gave away taxation during the war, and there was never the intention, as you're alluding to not take it back. It's just that's how... history was born out. The point, I mean, at the time of federation, Alfred Deakin said that the current structure would end up resulting in the states really being stuck to the federal government. And one of the biggest issues I have is simply not just focused on the revenue aspect that you talk about, but also on the policy aspect. One of the things that I find most frustrating in state government is not just simply the revenue, is the fact that a lot of the time state policies and requests for funding from the federal government is tied to federal policies. So let's take Gonski, for example, in funding. You know, we should be in a situation where if the federation was functioning properly, that states would be in competition with each other, looking at new ways to innovate and coming out with new ideas. That is stifled by a current system where the federal government will come out with a policy in whatever area, and the ability, the states have no choice. Whatever your philosophical position is in relation to that, the states it's necessary for them to get that funding, but they lose the ability to set the policy settings around those areas. So I think that is one of the key issues that needs to be dealt with over the course of this year when we're having this discussion about reforming the federation. But you're right, it's a once-in-a-generation opportunity, if it's looked at in a fair income way, to give the states back their rights on a policy setting, but also ensuring the vertical fiscal imbalance and all of those issues, that we end up with the states having control over their destiny and being able to fund the services that they need. I mean, why at the federal government level they have thousands of education bureaucrats but don't run a single school? These are problems that need to be worked out. And as I said in my speech, I think it's very important that the starting premise is what are the core responsibilities for state governments, what are the core responsibilities for federal governments, work that out, and then shape the federation accordingly, but allow states to have the ability to run their own agendas and their own policies in each of those portfolios. And that will, in my view, only be better for this nation, because we'll be able to learn from other states and what they do well, and we will also be in a competitive environment where we will have to deliver for our citizens, in contrast to how other states are delivering for theirs.
Final question down the back.
Minister, I'm just taking a question. You've
got to be quick, yeah.
In the last 30 or 40 years, more and more money has been spent on education, and the results have been getting poorer and poorer. We're in a situation now at the universities, your first-year physics students,
okay,
first-year math students, you cannot manipulate fraction. So what return are we getting for our money?
Okay, so the suggestion is we're spending more and more on education and getting less and less in return, I think.
Well, look, I think we've got in New South Wales probably the best education system in the country, and I don't resolve from that. I think we have a strong public education sector and a strong private education sector, and there's no doubt though that it's not about funding. Like, we can talk. I mean, you're taking a premise that we're putting all this money in, but we're not getting the outcomes. We shouldn't be looking necessarily at the funding. Sure, the funding is important, but it's about delivering the outcomes and making them comparable across states and other jurisdictions. The role of the Education Minister is to ensure that the results that we're seeing in primary education, in high school and in tertiary education continues to grow. But sure, we're putting funding into it. But one of the issues that I've always had, and it was around the times we've had those education debates around Gonski, the states have to take the funding, but it's important that we don't simply just throw good money after bad. Money needs to be tied, in my view, to success, and success of the educational outcomes at both the primary, secondary level and also going to the tertiary education area.
Take one more final question.
Just finally, a philosophical question. As a very young man in politics in a very responsible position, how would you feel about getting rid of the states? Is there the one level of government in this country that we could do without? No?
Look, you'd probably answer it differently if I was in federal government. but I guess as I've been in this role for a period of time, I've really seen, in my view, that states have a very important role to play. And I think that the people who are in the best position to solve a problem are those who are closer to it. I would very strongly advocate that, obviously education is an issue here, that New South Wales is in a much better position to be running schools and education than bureaucrats based down in Canberra have no connection to a school in New South Wales. I think the exact opposite, and that is that as part of the reform of the Federation, that we should be looking at ways in which the states have greater autonomy, as I've said. Why the federal government? We should look at why the federal government needs to, in my view, be involved in infrastructure. They could easily become. If you want to fund infrastructure projects within a state, it should be the state's responsibility, but they should have the funding to pay for it. And if you're running infrastructure projects across the eastern seaboard, then they should be partnerships between states. The issue, in my view, is not the abolition of the states, but it's actually giving the states back value for the tax dollars that people across New South Wales generate. And what we're seeing at the moment is the more inefficient states are, the way the GST operates, the more money a state gets. That's not how it should operate. States should actually get benefit, and their citizens should get benefit for efficiently run governments, and for governments that take leadership, that make the tough decisions on reform, like we're doing here in New South Wales, and striking out and innovating. And if we're doing good things here, then we should have the benefit from the tax dollars that our citizens across this state pay.
Minister, many thanks. Thank you. Well, Dominic Perrottet has made a very rapid move in politics from being a backbencher in Castle Hill to the New South Wales Finance Minister in less than 4 years. And I think we can see tonight one of the reasons for that. He's very thoughtful, very forceful, and very much thinking about how good policy can lead to good outcomes in New South Wales with relevance to all the other states in the Federation. So I'm sure, in view of your age, you'll be back many times in the future, but for tonight, well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.